each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito along with Loretta Fralick sitting in as we do every Monday for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change. Thank you for joining us today. It is terrible weather outside. I hope that you're all staying inside drinking something nice and warm and not venturing out unless you absolutely have to. Loretta, how was your weekend?
My weekend was fabulous.
Very
Mary.
Good.
How about you?
Very good. It was good. It was good. I was in beautiful Pittsburgh. At a friend's 60th birthday party. So it was very nice. It was a little nerve-wracking coming home into Midway, though, because we hit the storm just as it was coming in, and there was a lot of turbulence. And, you know, as you know, listeners, in case you don't know this, I'm one of these people that think I'm going to die every time I get on a plane. So it was not good for me. The poor woman sitting next to me, who I think still has my nail marks in her arm from where I was grabbing her. But I'm here, and I'm safe. And we are so pleased to be back because we have got a terrific show lined up for you today. This is going to be like the Chicago Old School Hour. And anyone who grew up in Chicago knows the name Milt Rosenberg because his show, Extension 720, was a staple in Chicago radio and in intelligent Chicago radio for so, so many years.
You're right, Mary. Yep. My mom used to say that if you listen to Milt Rosenberg, you could earn a master's degree. He was that brilliant.
Well, there you go. Exactly. You know, my mom and dad never missed it, or rarely missed it, I should say. And, you know, before there was Dennis Prager and Prager U, there was Milt Rosenberg and Rosenberg University, though, you know, this was before the age of social media, so he didn't have those opportunities, but it was, you couldn't not listen to that show and not come away with something you didn't know prior. So we are so grateful. We do not have Milt Rosenberg with us because he has gone to be with the Lord now, but we do have the next best thing, which is his son, Matt, who has written an incredible new book called What's Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. Matt Rosenberg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mary and Loretta. It's great to be with you.
Oh, my goodness. This is such a privilege. I was such an admirer of your dad's, and I knew your mom a little bit, too, because I met them at a couple of times at a social event, and it was I felt like a giddy teenager, you know, when I met your dad for the first time. I'm sure he was like, who is this strange woman? But I learned so much from his show, as I said in the outset, as I think many Chicagoans did, and it was the one place you could go and I think really hear intelligent conversations about sensitive issues where, you know, people didn't go crazy and throw talking points at each other. You actually had a substantive conversation. And I think Chicago's, you know, it's a great loss that there are so few shows like your dad's out there anymore.
Mm-hmm. And we face a related dilemma these days, I think, because it's increasingly hard to speak the truth about some of the major things that have gone wrong in the city of Chicago and other major cities, particularly in households at
right,
the level
right.
of the family.
Right.
And,
yes.
All of that ties so greatly to the violence that now racks the city. And I was motivated last fall as I watched this sort of violent chaos unfolding in Chicago to move back here and dig in deeper. And so I did, and this book resulted.
Yeah. And I feel like Loretta and I were saying just before we came on air that, you know, you wrote the book, that you saved us the trouble of having to write it, because, you know, a lot of what you lay out in your book is stuff that we talk about on this show, you know, frequently. We have a good friend of the show, Pastor Cesar LaFleur, who pastors a black evangelical church on Chicago's South Side. And he and I had a conversation one time here on the show about, you know, he grew up, his dad was a truck driver. His mom stayed home with them. I think there were six kids in the family. But he said, you know, not one of the children in our family was ever murdered or was in a gang, or everybody is employed. Everybody graduated from high school. And, you know, he said, my dad was just a truck driver, but my dad was in the home. Right. And we knew there were consequences
right.
for our behavior if we stepped out of line. And, you know, he really tries to, you know, encourage without, you know, trying to bring along people in his community who might, you know, have children out of wedlock and might not have a father in the home. But to try to really encourage the role of the father because of the ties that it has to violence in communities and to low graduation rates, et cetera, et cetera. So I know that, you know, you lay out you're in Seattle during the wildfires. It was poignant for me because my daughter lives in Portland, Oregon. And so I remember she was taking pictures. She goes to the University of Portland and was taking pictures from her dorm room. And it was like watching the Chicago fire come. She's right on the Willamette River. So, you know, she was like, Mom, I can always go jump in the river. I was like, dear Lord. But then we had all of this going on in Chicago at the same time. So you brought me back to that summer. You have your father's gift for using words to paint a picture. And, you know, when you came here, how long did it take you to write this book, Matt? It's fairly recent, I know, in terms of the time that you go back and look at it. But there's also a lot of wonderful Chicago history in it.
Thank you. I thought it was important to include particularly political history and also some memoirish material. I moved here in 1964 when my dad, Milt, got a job.
Right.
At the University of Chicago, and funnily, that radio show was really just a second job. He
right.
thought he might make enough money to get a new car,
but
to write the book
back in the day.
I
yeah,
know.
And it wound up
that
being
was
the,
his
yeah.
line.
What did he teach? He was social psychology. Was that it? His expertise?
Yeah.
Okay.
Social psychology. And it took me about 9 months to write the book in total, including coming back here and living here for 2 months and doing field work where I went deep into the South Side to talk in particular to black people in their homes and workplaces and get their thoughts about, you know, how we ended up here with, you know, broken public schools, a broken county court system, tragic city financial management, and this spiraling violent crime. And boy, did I get an earful from black people on the South Side. And obviously, as you know from reading the book, I talked to others, I talked to experts, and I reviewed the literature and did a bunch of other research and tried to weave it all together into something fairly readable. But what I take away from it all is that we're really at that point in the hike where you've got to make a crux move. And I use this analogy in the book, having spent a good part of the last 27 years with my beautiful wife, Patricia, hiking in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
You come to a point sometimes in a hike, even if you're not really a daredevil, and we're not, where one false step and the ball game is over. And so what you do is you pause, you reflect, and you look around, and you think very carefully about what move to make, because you're not going to turn back. You know, you've come too far already, and your destination lies ahead, not behind. And I realized as I articulated it that way in the book, that relates very much to our discussion about race. You know, we have the systemic racism trope that is advanced by Mayor Lori Lightfoot and many in the mainstream media and obviously academia, that is looking back as I do a bit in the book, at the very real white racism and systemic racism that did exist here, but it is not exceedingly relevant to the present day. And that was one of the things that I heard from black people I spoke to on the South Side, you know, at their kitchen tables, drinking sweet tea, at their workplaces, sitting down across the desk from them. There's just a great challenge ahead. So the crux move is really a number of crux moves, and they cut across all fields from K through 12 education to rigged rules of governance and our systemic corruption. Particularly even things like more foot patrols being needed in the community. We've got our cops driving around in their patrol cars, showing up only after the crimes are committed. And if we were to turn them loose to do foot patrols in, say, the 15 highest crime neighborhoods, and there are really just 15 out of the 77 neighborhoods in the city that are exceedingly bad in terms of violent crime. If we were to turn them loose to do that, we would hear a hue and cry from race hustling activists saying that this was over policing and that it was racist to even put more police feet on the streets. And the thing is, when you go talk to people on the South Side and West Side, black people, they do want more police. They also want better police. And so it's not an either-or proposition. So, you know, that's one of the crux moves. Expanded school choice, including making the Invest in Kids program in Springfield permanent rather than a pilot program. That program that gives a 75% state income tax credit to private individuals who make donations to scholarship-granting organizations so minority kids can go to Catholic and other religious schools. That's a brilliant program, and we need to make it stronger, not tear it down, as our billionaire Democratic governor has done. So there's a whole range of crux moves that I think we need to make, and I despair slightly because the leadership does not seem to be there for that.
You know, Matt, this is Loretta. I really think your book is simply brilliant. And as Mary said, it's saying all the things that we say in our dining room tables. And one of the things that I think should happen with your book is this should be given as a primer to anybody that shows up with the courage to move into Chicago. Yeah. And you are, I mean, what gave you the courage to name names? Because you name some pretty powerful people and you call them out. I mean, mm-hmm. You name Lori Lightfoot. You name Tim Evans. You name Kim Fox. And, mm-hmm. you know, and Pritzker, you call out Pritzker on his removing the tax credit. So what gave you the courage to do that?
Well, you know, I'm a South Side Chicago kid, you know, at heart.
Okay. We're both West Siders. We're both West Siders. I'm from Austin.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, more or less the same at root. And
yes.
I'm a strappy guy. I started out in journalism. One of my formative early experiences was working on a big corruption investigation.
Right.
Here
yeah.
In Chicago.
So you were with the Mirage. You did the Mirage thing with the
yeah,
Sun-Times.
Yeah. It was a very important experience for me,
yeah.
And I don't want to diminish that. I should emphasize I was like a young Forrest Gump. You know?
Right. Well, you know, Bob Hergeth from the Sun-Times is a friend of the show, and we were talking about just about investigative journalism, you mm-hmm. know, in general, and the R. Kelly thing, and now there's all this stuff about the ethics of investigative journalism, and you know, R. Kelly wouldn't be in prison, as Bob pointed out, if somebody hadn't, you know, put something on his desk in a plain brown envelope, you know, mm-hmm. that showed R. Kelly doing something illegal. So,
now, go ahead. But Matt, go ahead and tell us, what did the Mirage experience do for you to bring us this amazing book?
Well, it was part of the continuum of things, you know, working to help get an independent reform alderman from Edgewater elected to over the most nefarious efforts of the Democratic machine, just a year after the Mirage was another piece of it, you know, working in the suburbs as a newspaper reporter for the late, sometimes great, Lerner newspapers, and then working for the suburban mayors, battling Chicago City Hall over airport planning and policy. All of those things contributed. But the Mirage, I mean, it was like a primer, really, in how things worked, you know, behind the scenes in Chicago. So seeing, you know, the $20 bills being stuffed into the envelope and the envelope put inside the folded newspaper and left on the bench, and watching the conversation unfold between the bribe-taking inspector and members of our undercover team, and watching the way the inspector would casually sort of hoover up the newspaper at the end of the conversation. You know, all of that stuff. It was like, hey, this stuff matters. And I worked with a great guy who sadly just recently passed away, a sort of a quiet rock star of Chicago journalism, a guy named Bill Rechtenwald, who was the chief investigator of the BGA that summer of 77, but who later went on to do stellar sort of shoe leather investigative reporting for the Chicago Tribune, and then was a greatly loved journalism professor at Southern Illinois University for many, many years. So working with him and Pam Zechman and Zay Smith, just being in their orbit, you know, was enough to inspire me a little bit. And so certainly that's a part of why I came back here and why I felt an accounting is due. It's long overdue. And there are so many great investigative reporters like Bob Hergut, like so many others at the Sun-Times and the Tribune, and they've done super-duper important work, and I footnote, you know, a fair amount of it in my book. You know, we stand on the shoulders of the journalistic giants of Chicago, but one thing that's been difficult for anyone to really do over the years is sort of put the pieces together.
Right.
And to cut across, say, three or four or five policy areas, and then also look at sort of the governing ideology, if you will, and the core values and the big pieces of what went wrong politically in terms of the mindset, you know. And I lay it out in the book, you know, a creeping leftism,
yes,
which denies Black self-agency, a gross incompetence to actually deal with problems like rock-bottom achievement test scores for Black students on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, meaning fourth and eighth grades, and also the SAT, meaning, of course, 11th. Just utterly dismal education results, the spiraling public employee, pension debt, you know, so there's a grand incompetence. You've got the creeping leftism, the incompetence. You've got ambition, which turns power into an end for its own sake rather than wielding power for, you know, greater uplift of the electorate. That's rather huge. And then finally, of course, you've got the elephant in the room of corruption, which gives rise to a whole set of rigged rules of governance. So I thought, you know, it was important to put all the pieces together, and that framework was part of what helped me do it.
Right. It's just so masterfully woven together. And I want to, we're going to go to our first break, Matt, and then when we come back, I want to start with that corruption piece, because I think, you know, for Chicagoans, this is sort of in our blood and we know this, but I think for people outside the city, they don't realize how bad it is. So, listeners, please stay with us. This is a fascinating conversation already with Matt Rosenberg about his new book, What's Next, Chicago? Please do stay tuned. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change.
Winds of Change holds in our hearts and prayers those who gave their full measure in defense of our nation. Remember their sacrifice on this day of remembrance, Memorial Day.
I'm Loretta Fralick, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. All these years, you've been enjoying Winds of Change, Monday through Friday, on AM 750 WNDZ. And then, on Friday, you have to wait 2 days to hear Winds of Change? But take heart, because now you can hear Winds of Change on Catholic Radio 88.5 FM WFSI for Northern Chicagoland. That's Saturday mornings at 10, except on first Saturdays. Now, don't you feel better?
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and 88.5 FM WFSI. And we are speaking with author Matt Rosenberg about his book, What's Next, Chicago. And Matt, one of the things that jumped out at me reading the book is a paragraph that began, "Those who play it straight lose out." And it reminded me of my very first day of law school, where the dean told us we all had to be there because we would have a very special guest speaker. And that speaker was Terry Hake, who was the Grey Lord Mole, who had also gone to Loyola, where I went to school, and recommend also his book, Operation Grey Lord. But the dean said to us, I remember the day that we heard that Terry Hake had gone bad and that Terry Hake was taking bribes. And she said, we were just all heartsick because we thought we had taught him better here. But of course, Terry was a mole and was doing it for the feds. But you go in, imagine in the court system in Cook County, somebody with enough cash could get your criminal rape case fixed, could get your parking tickets fixed, could get your speeding tickets fixed. Hake's book has a bit of the theme that you bring when you draw out that the playing field isn't level here. Can you talk a little bit more about how you drew out this in your book?
Certainly. I start, I think, in a way at the near the end or three quarters of the way through, first by acknowledging that the corruption is endemic, but then I look at what it causes to happen. And I think that the rigged rules of governance that we have that are an outgrowth of our corruption to really keep the path clear for corruption. But in the course of that, something very important happens that's above and beyond sort of the evil and the wrongness of the corruption itself. And that is that the rigged rules of governance, for instance, municipal elections of Chicago held in odd-numbered years in the early months of the year, and the consistent turnout of only 33% in the local elections versus the 70% turnout from the exact same electorate in presidential elections. It's obvious that we ought to change state law if Democrats could be bothered to do so in Springfield and hinge Chicago's local elections to the presidential elections. But then you might have, 60 or 70% turnout in local elections, and it wouldn't just be public employee union members,
right,
and employees of large contractors who would be voting, as is the case now. So I think that's one of several very rigged rules of governance, which are created really to uphold the corruption. But one way I draw it out is by telling stories. There was a story that struck me in particular, and in the book I give credit to a Chicago journalist named Mark Conkle for the original telling of this story, but I elaborate on it a little bit. there was a black contractor who was trying to get a large custodial contract from Chicago Public Schools, and he found out that basically you had to hire a fixer, and he lost out in the end to a large company that had hired a fixer, and the contract had been coming his way. Oh. He had received letters that this $80 million contract was coming his way, but then he heard somebody's trying to wrest it away from him, and he went to speak to certain people who, John Hooker, among others, who now is among the four indicted in the Commonwealth Edison.
Right.
So it's a long story, and I won't go into it here, but I think I weave it together pretty well in the book. And it's I liken it to Russian nesting dolls. If you look, you know, if you look beneath the surface, there are just infinite layers of hands washing other hands. And the biggest takeaway for me is that policy, that actually doing the right thing, is never job one. It's not even job five or six, you know. It's always, hey, who sent you? Whose guy are you anyway?
Right.
You know, in the way that they say it down in Bridgeport.
Yeah, I don't want to talk to nobody that nobody sent.
Exactly. Right. Abner McPhy, I think, originally. Yeah. So it's a fouling, corrupting thing. And the point is that the whole purpose of representative democracy and enlightened self-rule, which after all is supposed to be our model of governance, you know, in the more idealized sense, that all of that has been so hugely subverted by a political system that puts, number one, blame shifting, e.g. Lori Lightfoot, and all of academia, you know, a political system that puts blame shifting and self-enrichment ahead of the public good. And so we've really run into murky water here, and we've been down in it for a long time, and collectively the city's head is sort of, you know, nearly submerged below the surface. We don't have much time left.
Right. Yeah, I know, and you point that out, that Chicago's mayor regularly deflects blame from herself and the administration by scapegoating racism or guns or, you know, President Trump or, you know, what have you. And I'm grateful that you, I was saying to Loretta at the break, I feel like your book is kind of a combination of a Mike Royko and your dad and John Cass all rolled together. But you speak in a directness and a courageous way that I think it has to be said. But like, you know, I keep thinking of the way your dad would handle sensitive issues and have the best people on to talk about them. And I'm so glad that you so carefully footnote throughout your book, too, and provide the, you know, the documentation to back up everything that you're saying.
Matt, I want to ask you a question. As a former prosecutor, you addressed the issue of bail reform, and nobody's getting any bail set. And they're all getting released.
We used to prosecute people here. We don't anymore.
Well, maybe we did. Yeah. But we at least set a cash bond. And what I don't think people realize is that's the money that the defense team is working off of in order to defend the individual charged with a crime. And so now I think part of the problem is that the courts are getting clogged because there's no resource that these defense attorneys are going to get paid. And yet Tim Evans, Kim Fox, the public defender, his name does not come to mind immediately, but all of these people agree that we should just let criminals go without posting any money. And why do you think that occurred, and why do you think it's not such a good idea?
Well, I think it's not such a good idea for the same reason probably that many others do. Innocent people too often die as a result, and it's not hard to do, but I thought it was important to document some of the very specific instances of people who died, almost entirely. You know, it's African American people dying at the hands of African American men who've been let out on no cash or low cash bond, you know,
or police officers, officers like Ella French.
Yeah. And the people let out who then, you know, resort to recidivism very quickly or quickly enough for things to add up to an awful mistake. You know, they've had often prior convictions. They may have gotten plea deals or especially low cash or no cash bond. And it's just an utterly broken system. So there was a first part of your question that I'd like you to reiterate. You asked a two-part question.
Why do you think that happened? Why do you think they've reduced it to no bonds?
No cash bonds? I think that's very important to go to the roots of it. So I think basically in a roundabout way, the universities are to blame. And I also think, you know, Tim Evans has his own legacy as a social justice warrior. You got to consider his past. You know, he went from being basically a black Democratic machine hack who worked under the infamous Claude Holman, who was the attack dog for Mayor Richard J. Daley I, against reformers. That's who Tim Evans came up with. And then he changed his colors when Harold Washington ascended and became Washington's floor leader and suddenly declared himself part of, you know, the Great Awakening. A reporter long retired for the Tribune named Anne Marie Lipinski actually detailed this, and I footnote the piece in my book back in the mid-'80s. When Evans was actually, I think, running for mayor at one point. So he has that background, and now here he is, chief judge of Cook County. This is his chance to be a social justice warrior and solidify his legacy. So I submit that's part of it, but I submit also there's something far broader going on, which is that, and perhaps you both can speak to this, the practice of law, you know, especially as it's taught in many institutions now, has been subverted by the social justice agenda.
Right.
And so this is exactly how you end up with a Kim Fox as Cook County prosecutor.
Right.
It's not about doing the right thing. It's not about real punishment for real crime. You know, it's about giving people breaks endlessly. It's about finding a way to sort of apologize institutionally for the continuing dysfunction at the household level in the African-American community. And
right. The
thing is, this whole piece of it and the systemic racism mantra of Lori Lightfoot is in itself deeply racist. And I feel it's important to articulate that the whole apologia, if you will, is that we can't hold blacks to the same standard as whites or Asians
right. Because
they're just not up to it. And
yeah. That
is deeply racist.
Yep.
And many black people
Absolutely. Recognize
that and resent it greatly. And a lot of leading black conservative scholars, from Shelby Steele to Glenn Lurie to Thomas Sowell to others still, finger that way of thinking very precisely and abhor it
right. And
reject
right. It.
Well,
I think, yeah.
And don't discount major source of donors, George Soros, with his $400,000 in a local race for state's attorney backing Kim Fox. And she also had a campaign appearance at his son's penthouse condominium for the election. So there's lots of things that are causing it.
Yeah, foreign money coming in. And you know, it's what you say is mindful of what George W. Bush said, you know, about the bigotry of low expectations, the soft bigotry of low expectations. And I don't know, Matt, if you've seen that new documentary, it's relatively new, a couple years old now, about Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas, in his own words, but he grew up in a house, or he was born into a house that had no indoor plumbing, he and his brother. He spoke only Gullah, which was a dialect of the Deep South. He didn't speak
right. Proper
English. And his mother, who was a single mother who did laundry for white people in order to, you know, just basically keep that small roof over their heads, sent him to live with his brother to his grandparents. And his grandparents put him into a Catholic school. And he talks about how he turned in, you know, a paper, I think this he was in eighth grade, that he hadn't spent very much time on because he just didn't feel like it. And I think her name was Sister Bernice. It was a great nun name. It was like Sister Mary Bernice of something. And said to put the paper down in front of him and said, "Clarence, I don't ever want to see garbage like this from you again. You are capable of more." And he said it was like somebody had kind of proverbially, like she didn't hit him, but she said she might as well have. And he said it was the first time somebody had said to him, other than his grandparents, who, of course, were very demanding of him in terms of his academics, "You are capable of more. Stop this nonsense. I don't want to see garbage from you again." And you have a great, point you make in your book. You say failing institutions, not racism, are the cause of the escalating shootings, carjackings, and murders. So let's talk a little bit about what you learned when you did the interview. We're going to go to our second break here, Matt, but when we come back, I'd love to talk to you about what you found, not only in the Chicago public school systems, but in the other institutions in the city that have undermined rather than empowered people of color. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich. We are sitting in today for Father Anthony here on WSFI Catholic Radio on both AM 750 and 88.5 WFSI. Please don't go away.
Winds of Change holds in our hearts and prayers those who gave their full measure in defense of our nation. Remember their sacrifice on this day of remembrance, Memorial Day.
I'm Mary Fiorito, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy, St. Stan's, is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich, and we are speaking this hour with author Matt Rosenberg about his amazing, incredible book, What's Next, Chicago. And Matt, you know, if there's one thing that can change the trajectory of someone's life in the city of Chicago, it's where you go to school. Grade school, but then also in particular where you wind up in high school. Can you talk a little bit about what you found in your research and just talking to families on the South Side about this stark difference between a kid who gets into a charter school or a Catholic school and the kids who are left to the public school system here?
You bet. One story that I was able to tell was that of a young black man, now 28 years old, named Jesse Mack. And he grew up in East Englewood. There was gunfire outside. He lived in the projects near 61st and Wabash. His mother was having a hard time. He had a stepfather who was a very suboptimal dude. Let's just leave it there.
And I know lots of those suboptimal dudes.
Yeah.
There's a Facebook meme waiting to be created there. Thank you.
And he went to a public, plain vanilla K-8 Chicago public school, and he didn't think so much of what was happening there. He shared with me that as a kid, he noticed when other students weren't getting it, the teachers weren't stepping up to deliver the knowledge. They didn't make that extra effort. He was able to skate through because he was a bright kid, but that school was actually closed shortly after he graduated from eighth grade. And in eighth grade, a man came from a new a local chain, if you will, of three all-male charter high schools called Urban Prep. And you know, they've had their ups and downs over the decades, but he was in the original class in the Englewood campus, and it made a world of difference in his life. And what he said was a couple of things. Number one, there were successful black men as role models.
Right.
There was a strict code of conduct enforced, but more than that, they were utterly, completely, totally serious about making sure that knowledge was apprehended and internalized. So it wasn't just taking tests and reading and doing exercises and taking quizzes. They would circle back and do additional evaluations, basically on subject matter mastery.
Mm.
And I feel, although I'm no, you know, there's no doctorate in education here, but let's really break it down for a minute. You know, subject matter mastery is crucial. In fact, I learned separately but relatedly, if you want to be an auto mechanic, you need to have a second year college reading level.
Hmm.
Because those manuals are just full of many, many pages.
Right.
And not all the words and sentences are small and simple, nor the concepts. So that kind of stuff is rather huge. And the Charter Public High School made a big difference. Long story short, he went off, got a four-year college degree in Ohio, then struggled, actually, to get into DePaul to go get an MBA, was rejected the first time he applied, continued working full-time at night, actually at Urban Prep, as an administrative assistant, and finally got in and went to night school and earned his MBA, and now he's the director of development there.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Education was huge. So too in that case and others was actually religious faith. And I mentioned that a number of times in the book because it turns up as so important to a number of the black people on the South Side that I spoke to. There was a continuing strand of faith and family. But I think if we're going to look at education, I would close out by saying, yes, there are 100-plus charter schools in the Chicago public school system. They are public charter schools. There's a great deal of inaccurate rhetoric that's always directed at charter schools. They're not all great, and when they fail, they deserve to be closed down, just like regular Chicago
right.
public schools.
Right.
And furthermore, the school choice debate has now expanded beyond that sort of stale old fight over, you know, charter schools versus regular schools. We now have, thanks to that Invest in Kids program, the state income tax credit, we have a more robust way to get minority students into private schools. That's tremendously important. There are 29 states with either vouchers or something like that tax credit program. And now we have something, thanks to COVID, believe it or not, called micro schools, which are sort of a form of homeschooling, but mm-hmm. not in the home. When parents can't be there, often public charter school students will gather together in someone's designated space, five or six of them at a time, with a private company supplying not exactly teachers, but adults who are trained enough to make the school day go smoothly and make sure that the students connect with their teachers online and that they're at it all the way through.
Right.
And that's super important because
yeah.
of the huge drop-off in minority student attendance during COVID at Chicago public schools. So the last piece, of course, is the Chicago Teachers Union.
Right.
You could do a whole show about that.
and a whole series of books, but yes.
Yeah.
The Reader's Digest version, though, if you have it.
Sure. They're reactionary. They are race baiters, class baiters, they're anti-police, and I provide ample evidence of all of that. They're really distorting and distracting the whole conversation. The debate, the Reader's Digest version is that the Chicago Teachers Union has made public education in Chicago about the betterment and job security of members of the teachers union, not about children and parents and what they need. So they're inimical as an institution, not as individuals, But as an institution, due to their radicalized leadership, they're inimical to improving public education in Chicago. And the good news, if there is any, is that more and more people are realizing how toxic CTU is. They're a large part of the reason that the last school CEO left, and she said so out loud on her way out the door. I think that should give us a pause for thought.
And the CTU administrator who was in Puerto Rico on vacation and, you know, zooming in from her beach chair at the pool during COVID. But you, Matt, you have a very interesting collection of individuals that you interviewed for this book. Can you tell it? I mean, I was really amazed by the twins that got out of prison and...
Volkers.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes, the Volkers. And the couple from Louisiana who...
Right.
Where did you find these individuals, and how did you develop a rapport that they were willing to be so open with you?
You know, I did legwork in the way that a reporter would. I have had a sort of a nose for finding black conservatives in the past. You know, I worked as a regular guest op-ed columnist for 3 years for the Seattle Times. I've done a great deal of writing over the course of my career. And I've always sort of looked for what you might call those crossover sources. You know, I think one of my favorite gets was the gay gun rights group called the Pink Pistols.
You are making that up.
I did not make that up. The Pink Pistols, they might still be out there, and they're for real.
I'm going to look them up.
they want the right to responsibly bear arms for the exact same reasons as other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gay Republicans in Seattle. You know, I've done a bunch of articles all over the place. So I've always kind of had a nose for that because I think those sorts of folks are very important. But the stakes are even higher in our big cities, and the stakes are very serious in the black community, as anyone there will tell you. And so the thing is, I think BLM and the attention given to their perspective, and, of course, this sort of guilty white genuflecting by progressives in the media and in government, this sort of default systemic racism trope coming from black, white, and Latino elected officials, the way the media goes along with all of that motivated me to dig deeper, and that's part of why I moved back here. So I rooted around online, and I found people such as the Reverend Corey Brooks,
yes,
at New Beginnings Church in Woodlawn, and it was through him that I became familiar with the Volker brothers, and through 1776 Unites, that Robert Woodson project, which is really an attempt to refute the New York Times' 1619 project. It turned out that Latasha Fields, originally from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that she had done some writing for them. And so, you know, I'm not shy, you know. You can probably tell. One of the things you learn as a Cub reporter, and which I did working for Lerner newspapers those many years ago, is, you know, find their phone number, get on the phone and call them and make your ask and get your get. You know,
yes.
And my get is, all right, I want to come talk to you. And I want to hear your life story if you're willing to tell it. And I want your take on some of these things that are going on in Chicago. And, yes, I'll have some very specific questions about crime and schooling and so forth. And so that's really how I did it.
Well, you know, Matt, you give 9 rules at the end of your book. And is in the few minutes that we have left, which ones are the ones that you think we in Chicago should focus on in order to overcome what next Chicago?
Well, let me turn to that section. I call these the South Side Rules.
Right.
And I make sure to be clear that these are from, you know, these are rules that I am merely really summarizing from my conversations with black people on the South Side. I think probably the biggest one might be rule number 9, that black-on-black violence in Chicago is a cancer.
Yes.
Confront the subject and don't fence it off.
Why can't we talk about it, Matt?
Yeah.
Matt, why can't we talk about black-on-black crime? You have an excellent quote here in your book where you say, it's okay for black lives to matter when a white cop shoots a black man. But what about when a black man shoots another black man, or a black woman, or a black child, or a black baby? Why? Where is the outrage?
Exactly. And I continued wrestling with that, and I think... And I don't think it's super complex. I think part of the reason that there is not that outrage expressed, especially by white progressives and elected officials of all colors, is we're still, it goes back to that, you know, baked in racism in the systemic racism argument that we hear trotted out so often. It's very difficult to call out a black person. For other black people, it looks like you might be giving aid and succor to white racists. That's a strand. It's been there forever, you know, and it wasn't that long ago we had a lot more white racists than we do now. So it's perhaps understandable. Maybe it's a unconsciously inherited tendency. I don't want to speculate, really, but you wonder. And as far as the whites and the assorted progressives of various colors, it's impossible to call out a black person because, goodness, somebody then might be able to call you a racist, you know.
Right.
And because the left eats its own, right?
Yes.
Right.
You know, all you have to do is, you know, use a word that's a legitimate word but sounds like an illegitimate word, and you can lose your job.
Right.
You know, it's just the environment is very touchy right now, you know? So
that's putting it mildly.
Yes. That's
very...
I wish it were touchy,
yeah,
Matt.
Yeah, I long for the days of touchy. And, you know, as you point out, and it is, just since your book has been published, you know, the number of carjackings in the community that have increased exponentially. We had a special ed teacher who lives in the southwest suburbs who was on her way home from a Sox game with her husband, you know, one of these random drive-by shootings, and she's killed, you know.
Let me jump in on that.
Yes, please. Please do.
I'm staying with good friends in Orland Park.
Oh, okay. Dear. Right. So you know the Hughleys, yeah.
Very, very dear, church-going folks, actually,
yes. Yes.
Whom my wife and I have known since the 1980s when we were all quite young, and they know the family.
Yeah.
The husband actually is in a local civic group with the husband of the woman who was tragically slain. So when people, you know, look at these things, it served to me as a strong reminder, you know, there are people affected, you know, and you might not even be 6 degrees separated from them.
Right,
you know,
right.
You might be just 1 degree separated. But it's gone nuts. I mean, I was just up in Wicker Park the last weekend and taking note of a nightclub shooting that had left one dead and 4 wounded, and a shooting in an alley behind the prominent Six Corners intersection.
Sure.
Where a man idling in his car was shot. Looking at the numbers of the astounding rise in carjackings, not just in the city, but in Wicker Park and Bucktown, and I will tell you, it's forcing a sort of a new set of perceptions on the hipsters and white progressives who live in those neighborhoods. And I love those neighborhoods, don't get me wrong. I hang out there sometimes. That's a big part of the duality of Chicago, which is, you know, great architecture, great culture, great food scene, beautiful churches in the neighborhoods, which I go out of my
St. Mary of the Angels in Bucktown is a national gem. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nonstop, and I tell you, having lived in Seattle the last 27 years, good place all in all, despite the political craziness and the fact that the downtown is a complete no-go zone, like Portland. But the churches in Seattle, all built by cheap Swedes.
Oh, no. It's like a big IKEA store, huh? Is it?
It's just not very inspiring. And so I come back here and wander the neighborhoods. And, you know, Ukrainian Village, Bucktown, Wicker Park, anywhere, the southwest side, the churches of Chicago are inspiring. So there's a lot to recommend a lot of our neighborhoods, but people there are suffering now from cognitive dissonance because they've, to borrow one of my dad's phrases, he actually helped elaborate that in the social psychology pantheon. Yeah, he started work on that at Yale in the late 50s even.
Mm-hmm.
But they are suffering from a cognitive dissonance in Hipsterville because they have bought the same rhetoric that Lori Lightfoot purveys about, you know, endemic systemic racism being the cause of everything. But now it's hitting very close to home, and it's harder to process.
Right.
So they resort to this sort of groping symbolism, and I have to tell you about something I saw on the wall of a taqueria at the Six Corners intersection right next to my favorite donut shop, Stan's Donuts.
I love Stan's Donuts. Yeah,
the pistachio glaze, right. Kind of hard to beat.
Right.
There's a taqueria with a picture of, you know, the famed national anthem kneeler, Colin Kaepernick.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right.
And he's gazing mournfully heavenward, and just in case we don't get the message, the artist has explicitly labeled him a martyr.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, this guy who has taken this great stand of not standing up for the national anthem. And so since he's labeled a martyr and gazing heavenward mournfully, I call him now the hipster Jesus of Wicker Park.
That's very good. There's another meme that you can create.
Where's Ruth Bader Ginsburg when we need her?
Exactly. don't talk about that. That's right. We're not supposed to talk about those things. Well, Matt, first of all, we have 2 minutes left, so I want you to be able to tell our listeners, I know the book's on Amazon. Everyone, I would just recommend so strongly you get it and read it. What are the other places that people can access your book, Matt?
Well, it's basically Amazon and then also online Barnes & Noble.
At Barnes & Noble, right. Yep.
And yeah, it was, and they can also find a buy the book page with blurbs and some long form essays of mine at my website, which is called ChicagoSchooled.com, but Schooled is with a K.
Okay, Chicago School. Well, Matt Rosenberg, what a privilege it has been. Thank you for your generosity in giving us an entire hour of your time. I feel like we could have talked another hour. We didn't even get into like thin crust or deep dish or anything like that.
But Mary, all you people that are moving into Chicago, you pick up a copy at the border if you want to understand Chicago and its politics and the state of the union in Chicago.
That's right. This is must read for anyone who's considering a move to Chicago or to Illinois. Matt Rosenberg, thank you again. God bless you and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Matt.
It was a pleasure.
Oh. All ours, Matt. Thanks.
Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed. Thank you. that you say when right from wrong has become so obscure, it does not take that long. Can you?